All right, we come to our second lecture by transitioning from the origins of the Augustinian formulation to its teachings. And I think Warfield gives us a helpful summary of his theology of grace under four headings. It's necessity, nature, efficacy, and means. So first of all, necessity. And under the necessity of grace, first of all, something about original righteousness. Augustine taught that Adam's will was positively good. God made man, therefore, as it is written, upright and hence of a good will. This good will had posse non peccari, the possibility of not sinning, but not non posse peccari, the impossibility of sinning. He had a possibility, not a necessity of sinning, but he could sin. Original sin. We must first speak of the essence of original sin. Just as the essence of goodwill is love of God, so the essence of evil is love of self. This love of self is the real essence of sin, that such is Augustine's conception as manifested from his magnificent presentation of the subject in Sermo 96, quote, "The first ruin of man was the love of himself, that is, his making it his will that he should will to love himself. For having forsaken God, he begins to love himself and is driven away from himself to the loving of the things which are without. Thou hast begun to love thyself, remain in thyself if thou canst, what is without. Thou hast begun to love what is without thee, thou hast destroyed thyself. Therefore, when a man's love passes from himself to the things which are without, he begins to lose himself, vain things, and to squander his strength like the prodigal. He is emptied, poured out, rendered destitute, and feeds swine. Such is the nature of sin, love of self, ignorance, concupiscence. Man falls away from God, wishing to serve himself, and he is drawn into the whirlpool of worldliness. Henceforth, his existence is but death." So he really doesn't end up serving himself, but serving the world in sin. We must speak, secondly, of the transmission of original sin. Since concupiscence, or sinful lust, is always involved in the act of sexual intercourse, now since the fall, sin is transmitted to its product. Seberg remarks, "Original sin is regarded in the light of real sin, as well as of guilt." In other words, original sin is really sinful, and it's really guilty. It is sin, and it is a divine penalty. It is propagated among men, not in the way of imitation, which is what the Pelagians would have said, but by generation, through one man, it entered the world, and it passes through all men. Although marriage is a moral good, though, of course, Augustine thought celibacy was to be preferred, yet generation never occurs without sinful concupiscence, as is proved clearly enough by the sense of shame associated with the act. And the concupiscence passes over upon the children. There's so much of his own past and experience here, isn't it there? Of course, every act of sex for him was associated with shame, because all of it was illicit, but at any rate. Quote, continuing the quote, "This is the case even when the parents are regenerate, quote, as from the seed of an olive springs nothing but a wild olive. Yet when it shall come to the act of generation, it is not possible that allowable and honorable intercourse should occur without the burning of lust, so that what springs from reason might be transmitted, not what springs from lust. Of this concupiscence of the flesh, which I grant is in the regenerate, not imputed as sin, it's previously described as venial sins, but which is not found in nature except from sin. Of this concupiscence of the flesh, I say, whatever offspring is born by virtue of its origin is bound to sin. There is a defect of the seed." There you have it. I'm not affirming Augustine's view. I'm just telling you what it was with all its original flavor. Now, the question of traducianism or creationism was not one on which Augustine could ever make up his mind. He actually has letters where he discusses the possibility of the preexistence of the soul. have to tell this story. I was doing my doctoral studies. I was sitting in a seminar with Ronald Nash, a well-known, now departed, famous Augustan scholar. And we were reading certain things, and I came across these letters where Augustine discusses the whole doctrine of the preexistence of the soul, which would be another alternative to creationism, the fact that each soul is originally created at conception, or traducianism, the idea that each soul is traduced from the souls of its parents. And I'm talking to Donna Goodwin, who at that time had nothing but a high school education, and she tells me all about the letter I've been reading in Augustine in my PhD studies. It was remarkable. I've been impressed by Donna ever since. At any rate, getting back on the subject, and Steve, you can tell her that I quoted her tonight. Creationism, according to Augustine, had difficulty with original sin. It does not seem just for God to create a human soul. If he creates it, it must be righteous and perfect, right? And then put it into a situation where it's sinful. Traducianism, on the other hand, seemed to fit well with the doctrine of original sin, because you traduce a sinful soul from the souls of the parents. But the problem was, it implies materialism. It implies that souls can be divided and passed on to children, and that's problematic. So he can never make up his mind on the issue. The third thing we've got to talk about are the results of original sin. Seberg says that for Augustine, all Adam's posterity were contained in him. From this follows, one, that his moral character becomes theirs, two, that the penalty pronounced upon him of being subject to concupiscence and death passes over also upon them. We have his sin, our burden with his guilt. Augustine says, quote, he should generate those subject to sin and death. Now, on the issue, if you're familiar with this, of realism or federalism, Augustine is not clear. What I mean by that is, there's the idea that in some sense we were really there in Adam's loins. Somehow our nature was present there, and because our nature was present, we were really there. That's realism. Or there's the idea of federalism, the idea that we were legally there. On that issue of whether we were simply legally there and Adam's sin is imputed to us merely, or whether we were really there and our natures were therefore tainted in Adam, because somehow we ourselves personally were really there in him. On those issues, really, I don't think we can say that Augustine is clear. Okay? Original sin and free will. What was the effect of original sin on free will? From the beginning of his life, Christian life, when he wrote on free will, to the end of his life, when he wrote on grace and free will, Augustine defended the freedom of man's will. A crucial distinction develops, however, and gathers clarity in his life. Warfield informs us, it is clear that he distinguished in his thinking between will as a faculty and will in a broader sense. As a mere faculty, will is and always remains an indifferent thing. After the fall as before it, continuing poised in indifferency and ready like a weather clock to be turned whithersoever the breeze that blows from the heart, will, in the broader sense, may direct. So, the idea is, men have a free will. They have a chooser, okay? They have a chooser. They had a chooser before the fall, and they have a chooser after the fall. They have free will. They can choose whatever they want. That's free will. And men may choose, not always execute, but may choose, may want, whatever they want. Okay? Free will. That's the Augustinian definition of free will. But that's the narrow view of the will. But more broadly speaking, this chooser is encompassed and controlled by the heart, will in the broader sense, okay? And it is the direction that heart is going that determines how will in the narrower sense will go. Does that make sense? So, and I think there's a lot of value in what Warfield is saying. Rather than sometimes you hear Calvinists just completely denying there's any such thing as free will, I think it's wiser, rather, in teaching on this subject, though in a sense, I think it's right to deny that men have free will. I think it's wiser to ask questions like, what do we mean by free will? How do we define free will? And come up people that way with the question about what do you mean by free will? And so, say in one sense that men have free will, in another sense they do not. Okay? The second place, having looked at the necessity of grace, we come to the nature of grace. We've already said this, but let's say it again. For Augustine, grace is assistance, that is to say, help from God. The word assistance to us implies help, which makes it merely possible to do something, okay? So when we think of assistance, we mean, well, I can't quite do it myself, I'm trying, but if another person comes, we can do it together. That's assistance, right? But that's not what Augustine meant in his mature writings by assistance, okay? Augustine's idea is that God gives a kind of aid by which a thing is infallibly accomplished. Quote, but now to the saints predestinated to the kingdom of God by God's grace, the aid of perseverance that is given is not such as the former, but such that to them perseverance itself is bestowed, so that by means of this gift they cannot help persevering. That's pretty clear, isn't it? You can't get Arminianism out of that. So the gift of perseverance actually makes it certain that they will persevere. It doesn't just help them to persevere, it makes it certain that they will persevere. Grace, as we have seen, is the infusion of a good will. Grace works through free will. It is therefore of necessity, prevenient, coming before the will, gratuitous, uncaused, and sovereign, independent in its bestowal. Right? Because grace works through free will, it works before free will, it works without the merit of free will, and it works regardless of what men are doing when it comes, because they don't merit or cause it in any sense. Grace works through free will. That brings us to the efficacy of grace. Augustine teaches irresistible or indefectible grace. Now, this assertion has been the subject of some controversy. You can imagine that Roman Catholics don't want to admit that St. Augustine taught irresistible grace, the doctrine of the Calvinist heresy. So, this deserves some discussion, and we're going to give it that. First, support for the assertion that Augustine taught irresistible grace, many things conspired to prove. First, this is a logical consequence of his doctrine of original sin. Second, this is a logical consequence of his definition of predestination as the preparation of grace. Predestination doesn't make it possible that people will be saved. It makes it certain they will be saved. And if it's the preparation of grace, it means that grace makes it certain that some people will be saved. Third, this is the logical consequence of his description of the gift of perseverance. They cannot help persevering. Well, that's efficacious grace. It's irresistible grace. If the grace of conversion is the same stuff, the same kind of grace, then it must be irresistible. Accomplishes what it is given to do. Fourth, this is the inevitable corollary of his interpretation of 1 Timothy 2:4 in the Enchiridion. In other books, who but a man who believed in irresistible grace would bother to limit this verse to the elect? Fifth, this is the explicit statement of Augustine. Augustine speaks of that sort of calling, quote, wherewith a man is made a believer. Well, that's effectual calling. Perhaps more clearly, Augustine comments on Ezekiel 11:19 about the taking out of the heart of flesh. The taking out of the heart of stone and giving the heart of flesh. He says, quote, this grace, therefore, which is hiddenly bestowed in human hearts, is rejected by no hard heart, because it is given for the sake of first taking away the hardness of heart. He says, how can you say that, God gives this gift, but hard hearts reject it? The whole reason God gives it is to take away the hard heart. Pretty clear, huh? Well, what are the alternatives to the assertion that he taught irresistible grace? Well, many Catholic theologians have been loath to admit that Augustine taught what amounts to the Calvinist heresy, and so have striven to find some alternative to this interpretation of Augustine. And it's remarkable, down through the Middle Ages, how many people just are wonderful devotees of Augustine, the great doctor of the church, and they don't understand a thing about what he said about grace. It is remarkable. This is why Gottschalk is locked up in a monastic prison for the last 20 years of his life for teaching exactly what Augustine did by people who claim to be the followers of Augustine. Remarkable. Well, but Catholic theologians have done this, and there are a couple of alternatives they suggested. There's the alternative cooperating grace. Tassell says, Augustine states repeatedly that the grace of perseverance is a grace that cooperates with men. And they're receiving this gift so that they do persevere, or their falling away is decided not by God, but by themselves. You see, Augustine says it cooperates. Well, the assumption of Tassell is that since the gift of perseverance is a cooperating grace, so is every other grace. But let Augustine speak for himself. But subsequent grace indeed assists man's good purpose, but this purpose would not itself exist if grace did not precede. And then he says as well, he operates without us that we may will, but when we will, he cooperates with us. We can, however, ourselves do nothing. The point is, what does persevering grace cooperate with? Converting grace, and so it always accomplishes its purposes. The cooperation is not with our original free wills or some nonsense like that. It's with the grace he's already put in us. So he converts us, and he gives us persevering grace, and it works with original grace to bring us to salvation. There's no thought, as we have seen already, that persevering grace may fail because it is trying to cooperate with a defective free will. Clearly, what Augustine means by cooperating grace is grace which cooperates with operating grace, which has converted the will. Since it is a good will that is being cooperated with, cooperating grace is just as effectual as operating grace. It is not two kinds of grace, but the same grace at two stages of our experience. But another alternative that's been suggested is the alternative of what's called congruent grace, congruent. The word congruent means fitting, coming in a way that matches our condition. That's the general idea of congruency. But let me explain. The alternative of congruent grace. This view maintains that grace is effective, but only because the call comes in a manner which elicits a favorable response from man. The call does not create the response. It is issued in such a way and in such circumstances as are congruent to an individual's predispositions. And so it's effective. You see, if God works just the right way, through just the right messenger, at just the right time, he can work with something in the person. At that point, he can lay hold of the person and convert him. It's not that the grace creates the new heart. It's that it locks into and manipulates something already in the heart, and if God does it just right, with the right messengers, the right time, the right appeal, all of that, then the person will be converted. And it can be effective, it will be effective, but not because the grace itself completely makes the new heart and the response. Now, there are certain statements in Augustine which may be amenable to such an interpretation, but none which are not also consistent with irresistible grace. For you see, in a sense, irresistible grace is, in a manner, congruent. The only way you can call a totally depraved sinner, a totally unable sinner, is irresistibly. The irresistible grace is congruent to his condition. He needs irresistible grace to be saved, and God calls him that way. The only congruent way to call a totally depraved sinner is irresistibly. This view, however, involves the idea that the divine call to both elect and non-elect is identical in character. It is simply not congruent to the circumstances of the non-elect. Portally, a proponent of congruent grace, holds this. Augustine, however, clearly contradicts this when he says, quote, God indeed calls many predestinated children of his, not with the calling with which they were called who would not come to the marriage feast. Many are called, few are chosen. God indeed calls many predestinated children of his, not with the calling with which they were called who would not come to the marriage feast, knowing that there is a certain sure calling of those who are predestinated. Therefore, he said, but of him that calleth, not with any sort of calling, but with that calling wherewith a man is made a believer. Also contradicting the idea of congruent grace is the teaching of Augustine that grace works subvolitionally. Subvolitionally. What I mean by that is that it works beneath the level of the will to change the will. It removes the resistance of the sinful heart. Remember, Augustine says, a grace is rejected by no hard heart because it is given for the sake of first taking away the hardness of heart. From a theological standpoint, the ultimate problem, it should read in your notes, sorry, the ultimate problem of those who advocate congruent grace is an inadequate view of original sin. Congruent grace supposes that something less than the renewal of our natures is necessary if we are to respond to the gospel. All right? Now, by the way, let me draw a line forward about 1,000 years, 1,100 years, and tell you about the Amaraldians. Now, you know Amaraldians as those who were what we call four-point Calvinists. But actually, Amaraldians error went farther than that. They taught that grace was effective, but they actually revived this idea of congruent grace. It's effective not because God calls people within exactly the right circumstances and time to make them come. So anyway, Amaraldians taught a form of congruent grace 1,100 years later. The means of grace. And first of all, the means of rebuke. And here we come to a very interesting book of Augustine, one of his last four, on the means of rebuke. It was entitled Rebuke and Grace. And you might wonder, what in the world's up with a book like that? Well, here's what was up with it. Late in his life, Augustine received news of a monk who objected to his doctrine of grace on the grounds that this would imply that we should not rebuke each other. Only pray, since God must give all anyway. So this is the old objection. If God is sovereign and grace is sovereign, why preach? Why rebuke? Why admonish one another? Because everything depends on God's grace, so why do it? And so Augustine wrote in response to that the book on rebuke and grace, and he said what you would have expected him to say. The object of this book, quote, was to explicate the relation of grace to human conduct, and especially to make it plain that the sovereignty of God does not supersede our duty to ourselves or our fellow men. In Rebuke and Grace, Augustine maintained that God ordains the means as well as the end, and that the use of rebuke is therefore necessary. Why do we rebuke one another? Because that's the means God uses to produce grace in the other person. Of course, the rebuke must be blessed by grace and the infusion of a good will, but that's what God commands us to do. The rebuke is the means. So rebuke is a means of grace. Well, this, I think, shows how exemplary and balanced Augustine's teaching was. But other means of grace, and here we come to something much more problematic, is the means of the sacraments. Warfield remarks that at this point, Augustine's doctrine of grace came into contact with an alien influence, his doctrine of the church. Now, I'm going to say some things here that I've said and you may have been surprised by it, but I have to say them again here. It was not because of his theology of grace or of his doctrine of predestination that Augustine taught that comparatively few of the human race are saved. It was because he believed that baptism and incorporation into the visible church were necessary for salvation. While grace might be conferred at some other time, the sacraments must always be associated with it, and they effectually confer grace. Now, that means if one who is not elect is regenerated in baptism, he will apostatize, though truly regenerate. So in other words, you have an Augustinianism because of this alien doctrine of the sacraments that Augustine is infected by. You have in Augustine this anomaly of some people who are regenerated by baptism who do not persevere to the end and are saved. Augustine then does not teach the perseverance of the saints in the sense that we hold it. Cunningham admits, it is right, however, to mention that in regard to the subject of perseverance, there is a certain amount of error and apparent inconsistency to be found in Augustine's works. He held decidedly and consistently that all who are predestined or elected to everlasting life are certainly infallibly enabled to persevere and do all, in fact, attain to salvation. But he sometimes writes as if he thought that men who had been the subjects of converting and renewing grace might fall away and finally perish. He held, indeed, that this falling away was of itself a conclusive proof that they had not been elected, and so far he was perfectly orthodox and consistent, but he does not seem to have been quite so certain that though not elected and therefore finally perishing, some men might not have been brought for a time by God's grace under the influence of sanctified principles or real holiness and yet totally and finally fall away. I think that's right. Again, let me draw a line here to 400 years later, and the disciple of Augustine named Gottschalk, he was locked in that monastic prison for the last 25 years of his life for teaching predestination by Hincmar of Reims, the archbishop. It's really clear in Gottschalk's writings, two things. He teaches double predestination. He teaches particular redemption. And then he teaches, however, that some reprobate may by baptism be forgiven of original sin and their past sins, but not persevere to the end and be saved. So on the one hand, he teaches that Christ died only for the elect. On the other hand, he teaches that by baptism, some people's sins may be temporarily forgiven and still they might fall away. Now, that seems really weird, but that's probably exactly the perspective of Augustine as well. And so what this actually means is that there's a stifling and stultifying effect because of his doctrine of the church and this faulty doctrine of the sacraments that stifles some of the natural results and practical conclusions of his doctrine of grace. You say what? Well, for one thing, this would lead to the conclusion that it's very difficult to have assurance of salvation, right? We think predestination, election, sovereign grace, that is associated with the doctrine of being able to have assurance of salvation, because once saved, always saved, and that's right. But Augustine believed that a person could be, in some sense, the subject of genuine grace through the means of baptism and yet not be saved, okay? So, I think we have to just be aware of that inconsistency. All right, that brings us to Roman numeral 3 and the development subsequent to the Pelagian controversy. And here I mean only in the next century or two. We're not going through what happened at the Reformation, although there are some interesting parallels between the positions that develop now and the positions that actually explode and are isolated into different churches at the time of the Reformation. And so I'll give you some external history traced, and then we'll go to the result and positions charted, okay? Semi-Pelagianism surfaced in a letter from Hilary and Prosper in 428 A.D. These were two followers of Augustine. They reported that in southern Gaul, soon to be the center of Western theological development, some were adopting, well, what they thought of as a semi-Augustinian stance. They rejected Pelagianism, but they also rejected certain Augustinian tenets. Augustine answered these semi-Pelagians in two books, his last, On the Predestination of the Saints and On the Gift of Perseverance. So these two books are actually written not against Pelagianism, but against semi-Pelagianism. One of the reasons why they're so clear. The leader of this movement was first John Cassianus, who died in 435. He taught that grace was resistible. Faustus, Bishop of Riez, now came to the fore. Both Faustus and John Cassianus were monks. In 474, Faustus taught that original sin leaves men with the possibility of striving for salvation. Though somewhat Augustinian, they denied the prevenience of grace, that is to say that grace precedes faith and the act of the will. Though they denied total inability, they had denied irresistibility of grace, and they made predestination according to the foreseen merit of faith. That looks a lot like Arminianism, at least original Arminianism. Some of you may know that Wesleyan Arminianism actually teaches a kind of prevenient grace, but not the original Arminians of the 16th century. The popes throughout this period rejected semi-Pelagianism and clung to Augustinianism. Seberg says Rome clung to the Augustinian doctrine, though indeed only in the sense of Innocent the First, i.e. with an ignoring of predestination. Innocent there should have the capital. Innocent the First is the Pope in question. The popes maintaining this position always pronounced Pelagianism heretical and also expressed themselves against semi-Pelagianism, where the semi-Pelagians are charged with preaching things contrary to the truth. Hilary and Prosper are lauded, and the rule laid down, let novelty cease to insult antiquity. Leo opposes Pelagianism, appealing to the doctrinal instructions of Rome. This pope from Africa expressed himself with exceptional thoroughness upon the subjects of original sin and grace. Strict Augustinianism was led at this time by Prosper of Aquitaine. The semi-Pelagian controversy was resolved, theoretically at least, at the Second Synod of Orange in 529. It decreed against semi-Pelagianism. Pope Boniface II confirmed its decrees in 530. The decrees of the synod were the work of Caesarius of Arles. He combined 8 decrees of his own with 17 decrees of Pope Felix IV, which were sent by him. The pope's decrees were based on Prosper. Walker says, I think this is a pretty good summary, Augustinianism was approved, but with undoubted modifications in the direction of popular Catholic religious conceptions. Its sharp points were blunted. These decrees exhibited two remarkable tendencies. There is, first, a weakening of Augustinianism. While prevenient grace is upheld, irresistible grace is neither affirmed nor denied. While predestination to evil is denied, predestination to good is not affirmed or denied. And then the other thing that you see here is a sacramentalizing of grace. The only long-range result of these decrees then could only be a slide of the Catholic Church back into a Pelagianizing doctrine. Let me comment on something here. Interesting to hear what Gottschalk has to say about one of the decrees of the Council of Orange. The Council of Orange, like I said, didn't say anything about election or predestination to good. It did deny that men are predestined to evil. Gottschalk says something to this effect. I'm not sure if his interpretation is right, but he wants to affirm the decrees of the Council of Orange, and so he says, yes, men are not predestined to evil in the sense of sin, but they are predestined to evil in the sense of predestined to the consequences of their sin. That is to say, they are righteously, on account of their demerits, reprobated to eternal punishment. So he wants to say that he affirms the Council of Orange because he does not believe that men are predestinated to sin, but to the calamities that result from their sins. Interesting. Anyway, the resultant positions charted. I hope this helps you, kind of gives you a scorecard, so to speak. There are five issues that were really in play. Real grace in the sense of infused ability, prevenient grace in the sense of grace preceding the response of the will and creating the response of the will, irresistible grace, unconditional election, and double predestination. As you can see, the Pelagians denied each one of those five things. The Semi-Pelagians denied all of them except the first. They did believe in real grace in the sense of infused ability. The Council of Orange said that real grace was true, prevenient grace was true. It's unclear about irresistible grace or unconditional election. And it rejects double predestination, at least in the sense of saying men are not predestined to evil, whatever that means. Augustine clearly affirms each one of these tenets. Okay? Okay, that concludes this lecture. In the next hour, we'll come on to begin to look at the medieval church. Do you have any questions? John, I'm unable to find my listing from outside listeners here. I'm not sure what happened to it. It's not in my column here. I apparently did something with it I shouldn't have, but it's not there that I can see. Thank you. John Ferguson asks, has the view on Pelagianism, semi-Pelagianism in the church today been softened and toned down from the label of heresy? If so, is this helpful? Probably, John, but going to what's beneath your question, I think that we ought to think of Pelagianism as heresy. I think we ought to think of semi-Pelagianism as serious error. And I think that's generally compatible with the Council of Orange. And, but if for myself, I would not want to call semi-Pelagianism heresy because to me heresy implies damnable doctrine, which if you teach and believe could damn you, and I'm not sure that semi-Pelagianism qualifies there, even though I think it's very serious error and leads in the direction of much more serious error and heresy. And I think there's a tendency of Arminianism to downgrade into rationalism and Socinianism and all sorts of, and into Pelagianism, which are heresy. Other questions? Yes, Dave?
Why do you think there's a desire, even back in Augustine's day and even today, to... there seems to be a desire to want to be able to lose your salvation.
To do what?
To lose your salvation.
Oh.
What drives that, do you think?
Dave is asking, what drives this desire to be able to say that people can lose their salvation? Well, sometimes I think it's simply the assumption, Pelagian and semi-Pelagian assumptions that drive that. If people can't lose their salvation, then you're beginning to admit that irresistible grace is true, and they don't want to admit that. But also, I think other times, Dave, it's a desire to somehow explain the facts of experience. I mean, and so, for a Roman Catholic who, or an old Catholic like Augustine, who in some sense, I keep saying in some sense because this is really confusing, I think, and I don't think he believes everything we might assume he would believe by saying this, but if you believe that baptism forgives original sin, and infuses grace into the soul, then you have to explain how some of those people that are baptized are clearly lost. And so I think part of it comes from the necessity laid upon these people because of their faulty assumptions, their sacramentalist assumptions about the sacraments. If you believe that the sacraments in some sense really impart grace, and then some people are lost who have had the sacrament of baptism, then you have to be able to explain that. So that might be another reason there. Blake?
How would you evaluate Augustine's sacramental errors? Like, how serious of an error would you say that those are in the end?
I think it's a serious error. And I think it's a serious error because it tends to produce, and to be consistent with, say, the Roman Catholic denial of the possibility of assurance of salvation. I think it's a serious error because it tends to... Let me be clear here. I don't think that Augustine and others like him who held a form of this, like Luther, I don't think they intended to say that people could be saved and would be saved by the mere sacrament of baptism apart from faith. I think they always wanted to say that faith needed to be joined with it at some point if the people were going to be saved. But so I think it has to be judged seriously. But we also have to be realistic and say, you know, unless you really want to go down the direction of saying that because they held this doctrine, Luther and Augustine weren't real Christians, which basically writes off most of the Christian tradition, then you have to say that this is a serious error and confusion, but we tend to take it right to its logical extreme of people being saved by water and faith not being necessary and all of that, and that's not what they believed. So it's confusing to us from our perspective, and we need to be careful not to attribute to them, though the error was bad enough, worse errors that we associate with it. Okay. Matthew Baker said, did Augustine ever see the necessity to discuss and establish an ordo salutis proper, if you would? Matthew, I don't think he ever used the terminology ordo salutis, at least I'm not aware of it, or maybe discussed it, except that it's implicit, isn't it, and even his semi-Pelagian formulation, by free will we obtain faith, by faith we obtain grace, by grace we do good works and are saved. So that's a kind of ordo, isn't it? But I don't think he thought of it in terms of an actual order of salvation. But again, it's implicit as well when he replaced his semi-Pelagianism with an Augustinian view of grace. There's implicit in it an ordo salutis, although I don't think you could ever find him discussing the ordo salutis in that terminology or terms, although I think it's implicit in a lot of things he says, but not in the theologically elaborated sense. I hope that helps. Other questions? All right, we'll take a break, and we'll come back at just after 8:30.